Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. I have a rather lengthy and I think quite interesting and deep and revealing interview today with author John Folak, who goes by the name The Traveling Nobody. And he recently sent me a series of four books of his, which I gobbled up very enthusiastically, really enjoyed reading them. And just finished reading the fourth book just a few minutes before we jumped on to our interview and spoke. And we've got that interview and conversation for you here today. Like I said, it's quite long. You might want to break it up into a couple different listens. Who knows? Or maybe you've got an hour and 40 minutes and you just want to chill and listen to two dudes talk about stuff and psychedelics. Maybe that's your game today. Before we get there, I do have a few quick announcements. First of all, thank you to Stefan for making his monthly contribution in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. Your financial support of this podcast helps to pay for bandwidth and storage, and also for the time that I put into reading books and doing interviews and producing the podcast and all of that. So if you'd like to support this podcast, I invite you to stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net and use the PayPal link at the top right of the page. Or you can also come over to Patreon, patreon.com/MartinWBall, and you can join up as a monthly contributor and get all the benefits of that, such as, you know, I recently finished up a new album called Temples of Light. And for example, over this past weekend, I made it available for free for my Patreon supporters. So that's just, you know, one of the kinds of things that you can get the benefits of if you join up over at Patreon. And speaking of the album Temples of Light, it's actually part of a conjoined art project that I've been working on for the past few months and have just finished the other part of the project, which is to create a book of visionary art, which is called The Celestial Cathedral and Temples of Light, an Entheogenic Evolution Visionary Art Book. Or excuse me, Book of Visionary Art. And I was just able to order the proof copy today, so it's on its way to come to me so that I can check it out and make sure that everything is good to go there. But it's a book of over 100 images of art, and it's going to be printed large size at 8.5 by 11 inches. So it's quote-unquote the largest book I've ever put out there. And it's definitely the book with the fewest amount of words. There's a very short introduction. Then other than that, it is all just art. And kind of the idea behind the whole project was that someone could get the album, Temples of Light, and listen to that while looking at the art and have an interesting experience. The album is currently available over at my Bandcamp page, over at martinball.bandcamp.com. It's Temples of Light. It's the top album that's available over there at that page. And it's going to be populating out into the internet, actually under a different name. This is the first album that I've put out of solo music that I've not put my name on. I used the name of my character, Orubai, to kind of tie in with, you know, other things that I've done. And as I've probably mentioned before here on the podcast, that my music has been eternally associated with another Martin Ball online. And this Martin Ball has one album called Come to the Throne, and it's all Christian praise and worship music. And for whatever reason, like on Apple Music still today, my primary genre, even though we've had our music separated through years of me harassing Apple and other online retailers about, you know, we're not the same person, my music is still listed as Christian gospel on Apple Music. And I really feel that that's a limitation for my music being found by other people who might actually enjoy my style of music, which is not Christian praise and gospel music. So anyway, I'm releasing this album, Temples of Light, under the name Orubai, just to kind of see what happens. So it's not with my name, and maybe it will get, you know, sorted into the right genre groupings and other people can find it. But anyway, the book is going to be coming out very shortly, as soon as I get the proof and approve of that. I just have to hit publish and it'll be available on Amazon and all of their marketplaces, and the album is available now. Anyway, that's enough yabbering away. We've got a long conversation, so let's go ahead and jump right on into it. Probably be back with another selection from Being Infinite here on the podcast next week, and more interviews to come. So tally-ho, carry on, jolly good, all that stuff. Here's John Folak, the traveling nobody. All right, well, I am joined today on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast by Mr. John Folak, also known as the traveling nobody. That would be his pen name. And John, you sent me a series of four books. I got them right here, and I got to tell you, just to use a little bit of your language, I totally dominated and smashed these pages over the past week and really had an enjoyable time reading your books. I dig your style. I like your take on things. I would say there's a lot of momentum in the books, and they were thoroughly entertaining and enjoyable. But I guess that they're actually your second project. So you mentioned several times, like the first, what's the name of the first book?
Psychedelic Hero's Journey of a Traveling Nobody was the first.
Yeah. Well, I haven't read that one, but let's start there and kind of, you know, let's get to know you and your journey into being an author and sharing about your psychedelic experiences, which largely revolve around mushrooms, not exclusively, but I would say quite largely, and generally large doses as well. So, yeah, well, maybe first let's start with this. Where in 3D reality are you joining me from today?
I am in Austin, Texas, in my apartment.
Okay, so you're still there. That's kind of where the books wrap up, that you were in Austin, and so that's awesome. All right, well, I've asked you enough questions to get us started. Tell us a little bit about yourself and starting your journey as a psychedelic explorer and as an author.
Sure, sure. And first of all, let me just say thank you very much, Martin. I appreciate you having me on here, and I appreciate you taking the time to read the books, dive in, and see if we could compare some notes, which is really, I think, what we're doing in this space, right? Those of us who feel like we're called to put forth in writing the cosmic journey. And I did read Being Human, your first book, and I'm just finishing up chapter 3, or I just did now before starting of Being Infinite. And yeah, obviously we're sort of coming from the same place, which I think is the ultimate self, right? Yeah. And we're just describing our angles and the notes that we've taken and the understandings and realizations we've had along that journey. And you're doing it really authentically, and that's the language too. I love that. It's just as real as you get it. I mean, that just gives, I think, us all the best chance to understand one another. And understanding might be something like the mechanism by which we do recognize the capital S self or something like that. Yeah. So that's cool, man. I really dig that. And it's just great to meet another person doing the same thing. And I totally get where you're coming from. And you seem to kind of get where I'm coming from. So
to not
avoid your question, which I wasn't trying to do. I just wanted to put that out there.
I appreciate that. Cause you know, I recognize a lot of similarities. You know, obviously we've had very different paths and, very different experiences, but there was a lot of things that really resonated really well with me within your books. And again, I just really like the style, just kind of this upfront, honest, kind of brash, and just adventurous. Really enjoyed it that, you know, I get a lot of authors who reach out to me and, I generally enjoy the books that I'm reading for people that I'm bringing on the podcast, but I really just ate these books up. I mean, I just had so much fun with, you know, it's been a little bit, hasn't been like a full spring yet, but we've had some warm days and I actually just sat outside and was just out there reading and it was great. Really kept me entertained and, enjoyed the insights all along the way and also just enjoy your writing style. So
thank you. Yeah, that's pretty high on my personal value hierarchy in general, is just to legitimately find points of genuine connection. And in this series of books, I've tried to essentially set up like a campfire story atmosphere where this is what we would do, right? Just in written form, if we were chilling by a campfire and hanging out, we would exchange stories like this. And hopefully that form has taken place in these books to some degree so that it has that vibe. And it sounds like you definitely picked up on that intent. So thank you, man. I appreciate it. Hearing that hit home. But yeah, just to get to the main question, I started writing very shortly after my first formal ayahuasca ceremony that I went to. And that was at the end of 2015. I felt called to it, for lack of a better way to describe it. And this was after I had explored the mushroom for a couple years, really. So what it was that brought me, in short, to the psychedelics, I always like to be very clear about, it truly was that I sought to heal. I was depressed. I was heartbroken. specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what the real call to adventure in my life was. Of course, you could always kind of go back and say, well, what was the cause of that effect? And you could do this forever, right?
Yeah.
But if I'm really to place a wake-up point on my journey, it was the first legit heartbreak I went through. And so after that, I was attempting to find natural cures for it. And this led me to essentially just trying to figure out what that would look like. So I started Googling. I think I just straight up Googled how to cure heartbreak, because this was something that my model just didn't have a place for. I was physically fine. And in short, what I'm talking about, my worldview was I was an alcoholic. I was a materialist. And I was feeling the physical repercussions of this heartbreak. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I lost 10 pounds in a week. It was terrible. It was pain and suffering. So this didn't fit, and it caused me to start to look into, well, I mean, what caused it in the first place, and then how to start to correct that. But then, of course, how to actually long-term heal. It took me about a year and a half, but eventually the mushroom called to me. And so I grew my own. That's how I started in the whole psychedelic territory. And then I began exploring it, and I got nothing but benefits from the process. So at one point, leading back to the ayahuasca ceremony, which brought me to writing, I went into the mushroom with a very specific intent, and I think this will resonate with you. I asked to see the all. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know, right? I wanted to know, what is it? What is that underlying suchness that animates the physical and non-physical worlds? What is that?
Yeah.
And it was a heavy dose. It was a heroic dose, about 5 dry grams of mushrooms alone by myself, closed eyes and all of this. And eventually they said, the mushrooms told me in a nutshell, that they weren't the all. They were a branch of evolutionary life, not in that way dissimilar from humans, although quite dissimilar, but they were just a branch of the evolutionary life tree, right? But they said, look, we know more than you do. You space primates do. And this is it, if you want to know. And they showed me a blue Möbius strip atop the void of black space, which essentially is a figure eight.
Yeah.
Basically, that's what it was. So the infinity symbol, of course. And that might not be too surprising. Like, of course, the infinity symbol is representative of being the all, being the Godhead, the self, right? So from there, I had this feeling associated with it, which was, of course, that feeling that, we really are all the imaginations of ourselves, right? And we're all just like the actors of the cosmic drama from these different roles and all of this. Yeah. So that was there. But I suppose it might have been my inability to process or properly and maturely interpret that at the time. And I felt a void. I felt, well, that's it. So that was basically my feeling. And I tried. I remember coming down. I really tried to be seen, if you will, the silver linings or whatever to it. But I just inherently felt the glass half empty interpretation of that teaching or lesson. So then that caused me to seek out other plant teachers, because up until that point, it had been exclusively the mushroom that I went to with my questioning and for answers. And it had delivered a lot. But that kind of caused me to say, hey, if I'm going to investigate any particular subject, being someone of generally reasonable mind, I attempt to, of course, as anyone would, a reasonable mind, find out what the different sources are and then triangulate your information, right? That's just the process of understanding.
Yeah.
So I applied the same process and I said, well, I'm going to go seek out Mother Ayahuasca. And that was my next call to adventure into that territory. Basically, what it looked like was I deeply resonated with a song that I heard played from an ayahuasca center in Costa Rica. And it was just one of their sort of, I guess, promotional-esque videos that they had. And it really called and spoke to me. It vibed with me, right? Quite literally.
Yeah.
So I looked into the place a little bit, not too much at all. And I said, I've got to book it. And I did. And I booked it out. And this took me up to about the end of 2015, and that's sort of where I started this little jaunt here that I went off on with this mushroom tangent, but I wanted to just clarify what brought me to ayahuasca.
Yeah, well, so, actually, if I could just pause you for one second. Just one of the things that I picked up on in your books and about this mushroom experience that you're talking about right now, I don't know if you've seen the back cover of my book, Entheogenic Liberation.
Oh my God. I haven't. No, I did not see that back because I was looking at it on Kindle, but that's exactly what it was in black space. It was the infinity symbol.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, I just wanted to share that with you here. You know, of course, you know, the podcast that goes out, this is just audio, so no one's going to see that. But I was, you know, I was reading your account. I was like, oh yeah, I know what he's talking about. I've got that right here.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's just a lot of just areas of like, oh yeah, yeah. And actually, well, no, I'm not going to fast forward. If you bring it up, there's another interesting comparison that I'll make along the way. But anyway, so getting into ayahuasca and the song that brought you into ayahuasca. It's just,
right.
I love how just the breadcrumbs, right? It's like the little breadcrumbs and like, and that's really the sign of intelligence and curiosity, is not assigning too much meaning to the breadcrumbs, but also paying attention to the same time and kind of being in that balance of like, okay, well, I've got an intuition. Maybe I'm going to go over here. Maybe there's something for me here. So that's what you felt with ayahuasca. Yeah.
Right. It's just following that next breadcrumb. Exactly. I use that term all the time to describe this sort of thing. And I have in my life that next call from the unknown to understand. So exactly. And there are a bunch of notes we could continue to compare throughout. I'm finding a lot of just little similarities in your writing too, which is cool. But anyway, so I went to Costa Rica. I went to the center and I had my ayahuasca experiences. In a nutshell, it was the same suchness. I was given essentially the same lesson, the infinite, but it was much more filled with, for lack of any other better word, love.
Yeah.
It was very, very warm. It was very glass. I won't even say half full. I'll say overflowing. There was a huge emotional component to me, to the experience, that was in my benefit. It was almost as if ayahuasca seemed to really care about the emotional construct of the questioner, me, and then how its answer would be received. Like it really cared. Whereas I felt like the mushrooms were like, well, you want to know, we'll tell you. Matter of fact, how it is, and do with that what you will. Which is not to be discounted. I mean, that definitely set me on the course. But anyhow, that's what the experience was with ayahuasca. So then leading right back into how that started taking form in my life, I got back. I said to myself simply, this has been too much of a journey that has had undoubtedly similarities to many others out there. And I just felt compelled to write it. I had to. I've heard it talked about by other writers before, and maybe you'll definitely vibe with this too, that the call of writing in some circumstances is something you can't refuse. You have to. A writer writes because he has to. It's nothing that I ever set my intention on necessarily before any of this. But then when that was upon me, I just said, well, this has to happen. And for the last 8 years, I've basically been involved in that process.
Yeah. So I've got a few questions that just spring up. I'm just trying to think of which one to go to first. So I'll go to this one first. This is the deeper one. This is the heavier one. That your process, it seems to have been initiated by heartbreak. And, you know, here's one of these parallels that, you know, if you're reading Being Infinite, I don't know how far you've gotten in there, but that was definitely a big part of my own process of kind of processing heartbreak and then looking for love, but there's different aspects of love, right? So there's the romantic relational love between subject and object of the lover and the beloved. Then there is perhaps the universal overflowing of love, such as in the ayahuasca experience, which does not necessarily have an object. And then the core of it really is self-love. So I guess my question that I'm coming around to is, within this process, and maybe it's still part of your process, how do you feel this has contributed to your own sense of self-love, self-worth, and value within your own being, independent of any particular relationship? And I know you've got a lot of dances with a lot of goddesses, you know, throughout the books, but that seems to be kind of one of the core issues of that ability to love the self, even in the face of disappointment, rejection, undesired results, etc. So
that's a really good question, and I'll just straight up answer it as clearly as I can. I've not figured that out, and that's certainly what I'm engaged in right now. And I think specifically the way that's taking form with my life is being very real about who I am in this world and what I have to offer. And it is this sort of everyman explorer of the psychedelic realms, the visionary spaces, and then putting that forth as genuinely as I possibly can to the world. And my hope is that by doing this, I will recognize more unique value in that self, and then be able to perhaps generate some of, or come into some of that self-love that you're speaking. Now, ultimately, I think it's all sort of the same thing. And I can see you hinting at that, right? You have like just the love suchness that animates all. Of course, you have relational love, love of self, and all of these different ways you could frame it. But isn't it all a part of the capital S self, right? Like that ultimate suchness? I mean, it is. And we're just talking about different reflections of it. But within three-dimensional reality, within life, I do think we have to learn how to develop in those individual and independent pathways. So like the pathway to self-love, that is an endeavor. And that is something that, at least for me, I've had to be really focused on in terms of bringing legitimate value to the world so that I could see it too. If that makes any sense, that's basically the path that I've found to that. And it's certainly a work in process. In a nutshell on that, I'll just give you my basic formula, what I've distilled to be of value for my journey and what I think is universally applicable, although of course they're just lenses to be placed on, like all philosophies. I think if we're to accept that we all basically are on the journey of life, I think we're headed somewhere, right? Return back home, perhaps. And it might also be that along the journey, there is a treasure to be had. And I think that treasure is something like highest and best personal use. And the way that I've seen highest and best personal use within the framework of the Matrix and the visionary spaces is that it's really the best way that you can live for yourself, which has everything to do with self-love and self-worth, while simultaneously being essentially the most harmonious way you could plug into the collective. I think that's a real pathway. It actually exists, and it's very difficult to find. It'll take however many iterations of the life cycle to get it. And I just mean within this life. It's going to take a while to figure out what that is. But it's the most worthy aim that we could possibly have, and that's what I'm involved in right now, is making that a reality for myself with being essentially a psychedelic author and bringing that forth to the world. So hopefully, having done that, you can begin the real integrative process of returning home, bringing value back for the tribe, society, and collective. And now I would say that that is potentially the best strategy to find sustainable fulfillment in the world, like the real wealth spring of eternal youth or something like that, right? So that's sort of how I frame all of that. I hope that kind of answers your question, but specifically to the self-love thing, that's a real process that I am ever working with.
Yeah. And you know, it comes through in the pages that it's interesting because these books are all autobiographical, and in some sense, they're also to a degree self-effacing, that you are the central character. You are the hero of the journey and the story. And you're simultaneously giving us a lot of details about yourself, but then, you know, you also do, you're using the nom de plume of traveling nobody. And so there is that sort of everyman quality, that it's about you, but it's also presented in sort of this archetypal way, that it could be anyone having these experiences. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that there's a lot of momentum in the book. So it's like, I'm going to the fridge. I'm dominating this sea life. I'm going to the bar. I'm getting in the car. I'm getting in the roadboat. You know, there's a lot of movement. There's not a lot of details about your life, even though there are a lot of details. And it's sort of an interesting authorial trick that you've created here. So this is where I want to get back into asking you about finding your voice as an author and about writing. So from the autobiographical material that we're able to glean here, you were involved with airplanes as piloting and geological or like city mapping, something like that. So going from a non-writing profession to being a writer, you know, how was that transition? And then did you have to go through a process? You know, I know that from what you've described here, that Joseph Campbell's work on the hero's journey, that became very fundamental for you. It's clear that you're quite well-read. You read a lot of different authors. You include a lot of different perspectives. But then in developing your own unique voice, which I do think is a unique voice, and that's part of what I really enjoy about these books, is like, damn, this is kind of a cool dude. I like his take on things. I like the use of language. It's very direct. And again, it has a lot of momentum. It's like, I want to get okay, let's the next page is the next section. And I like the little subtitles that you got here. Smoke it already. Now, blanket overhead. You know, it's just like boom, boom, boom. It's kind of like sort of a Zen nature to it in a way. But anyway, that's me rambling on praising you, which I think, you know, I hope you can receive that as well. You know, yeah. So sometimes the author's like, oh, no, don't praise me. But no, I really dug these books. I really had a good time reading them. So back to the question, finding your voice as an author and deciding what kind of style you want to communicate. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much. I do receive that. That really warms my heart. I mean, I think that's the underlying reason why I really want to do a lot of this is just to connect in such a pure way like that. And what better way than to, for lack of a better way to describe it, bare your soul and have someone really pick up on it and vibe with it. That's just a beautiful thing, man. So thank you. That means a lot. But yeah, how did my voice sort of develop in that territory? I think it just naturally happened through the process of writing. Like I told you, I felt as though I had to do this.
Yeah.
So I sat down. Yeah, that was it. So I sat down for the first year and a quarter with my first book, Psychedelic Hero's Journey of a Traveling Nobody. And that one was just very long. It was more traditionally autobiographical, I suppose. And it was critiqued by some people within my circle as being like almost academic. It was just a little bit too much. And so I took that fruitfully and I said, well, yeah, they kind of got a point. I mean, it was 127,000 words, 362 pages. It was just a big thing to digest. And I suppose the goal was never to make a ton of money from these things or anything like that. But you wanted to connect, right? That's obviously the goal. So I took that criticism and I said, okay, well, that's useful. What can I do to connect more legitimately? And of course, throughout the process, you end up camping with people, you end up telling people your stories. And I realized this is seemingly pretty entertaining when I talk to people about it, or if they're interested to ask, right? And I give them a story. They seem to like it. I mean, they don't just stare at me. They're engaged and all of that. And I thought, in a nutshell, if I could bring that to the written project, that would be my authenticity. That would be the best way to connect, right? To facilitate that process. And that's what I was after. So then I did with these books. And of course, even in the process of doing that, I think you get a little bit better at it. It's interesting that you complimented the sort of style. And I will say thank you again, but so much of it just wasn't exactly conscious. It was that I was attempting to be as authentic as I can with the reports and simply just describe in a journalistic or reporter type fashion what happened in that trip. And that's what I would do. I mean, sometimes it would be shortly after the trip where I write it down, so it's fresh. Other times, not so much. It would be a month later or so because, as you know, you have to let those snowflakes in the snow globe settle a little bit to really see where everything lays itself out and to gain some of the lessons and the values from the trip so that you can actually even speak about them in a productive way. So anyhow, it evolved naturally from just doing it. And that ties me back into my basic formula. You hear that call to adventure, the call in the world to move yourself forward and do something that you feel you have to do when you take it. And then it sort of does begin to give you a feel of its benevolence, of it sort of being on your side, if you will. And that process is, of course, where the voice is more sculpted and the authenticity, I think, has a chance to really root. And I think that only got better throughout me doing it. And that's been undeniably valuable, not only to write and be able to tie sentiment to word, let's say, in that way and convey meaning usefully, but then just to even have that process go on with yourself, right? Because that's what it's all about. If you could be authentic with yourself and honest, now you give yourself a chance to actually grow and develop and see past some of your programming and cycles and all of that. So that's basically how it happened. It happened from hearing the call to write and then from just letting that evolve as it would.
Yeah. And then in sort of capturing this narrative, one of the things that I really enjoy about this, again, sort of from the any man, the nobody perspective, is that, you know, these are not a series of books about how, oh, well, then I went to Mexico and I met with this shaman and I ate the mushrooms and we had this sacred ceremony. I mean, you've got a little bit of that with, you know, with the ayahuasca, but mostly this is you taking mushrooms and going to strip joints, hanging out at pools, hanging out underneath the blanket, sitting on your bed, going out camping, having conversations with people, going to regional burn events. And, you know, throughout all of it, you are really analyzing your own integrity, you're analyzing your motivations, you're analyzing what is drawing you forward, what conclusions you're reaching. And that to me kind of speaks to that sort of everyman perspective that, you know, there's a lot of people who, you know, every month they fly off over to Peru and go drink with the shamans and then go to this ceremony and then go to that ceremony. And, you know, as I think here's another parallel that, you know, I had been rather raised as a materialist as well. I've never really been into ceremony. I've never really been into ritual. I'm into exploration. I'm into self-analysis. I'm into honesty and transparency. But that's one of the aspects that I really enjoyed about the narratives and the stories is that it's like, this is just some dude who's out there taking mushrooms and he's getting a lot from it. And he's not, you know, it's quote unquote sacred. It's special. It's revelatory. He's, revealing, you know, fundamental truths of the nature of being to himself. But it's done in just such a fun, sort of casual, yet also serious way, so that there's that interesting sort of dynamic mix that's in there. So then in going from the more academic presentation, as you've described for the first book, consciously, how did you come about with, okay, well, this is the voice. So just to share with everybody, the first book is The Organic Spaceship, Opening the Psychedelic Door. Then we have The Digital Motherboard, Love, Fear, and the Quest for Truth. Then Beneath the Surface, Trusting the Call to Adventure. Then Unexplored Territory, The Search for Home. These are all great titles and great subtitles. And each book is a little bit longer, I think, than the one before it. Well, maybe no, that's not true. It looks like book three is a little shorter than book two, but book four is definitely the longest. But yeah, so then making that transition. And here's another place where I would say I feel a parallel with you. So my actual first book is my novel, Orbeez Vision. And I wrote that very shortly after getting out of graduate school. And the first few drafts of that book, nobody had read it, so this is just my own critique of it, was that this was way too academic. Like, I could tell, like, okay, here's someone who's trained in anthropology and religious studies and is trying to make a novel. And it took me a while to figure out how to write in a novel voice rather than the academic voice. So how was that transition for you? I mean, obviously, you got that feedback, you took it in, and then sort of developing the voice for this series of four books.
Right. Like I was saying, it sort of just came to me that I had to just dive right into the meat of the material, basically. So in the very first book I was telling you about, Psychedelic Cures, Journey of Traveling Nobody, is just very long. And of course, within that, there were trip reports, but there was a lot of writing outside the trip reports, right? Mm-hmm. So in short, I basically thought to myself, if I were going to buy a book like this, of this nature, in this category, I'd probably just care about the trip reports. I wouldn't care too much about everything else. Of course I would in some sense, but you know what I mean? It's like, that's sort of where the main meaning is or something. So I just decided to write from that position. And let me just note here too, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know that I would be publishing these things. I didn't know that they would be a series. I didn't know any of that. This happened in the summer of 2017. I basically finished the first book. It took me a year and a quarter. I was done. And then I was just working, basically, and sort of adrift. I was just looking for the next call to adventure, the next breadcrumb. And a friend of mine actually asked me to write up the first chapter of the first book, The Alcoholics Run. He asked me to do that for a previous job, a chat room that we were all in. He said, yeah, you should write that story up. We've all left that job and it would be funny. And I thought, yeah, it would be funny. So so I wrote it up. And that was it. That was igniting me. I thought, wow, that fits nicely with perhaps where I'd like to evolve this process into, or allow it to evolve and me just to be the medium for it. And I realized in that story, it's short, it's sort of to the point, it's campfire-ish story-like, it's somewhat entertaining, and hopefully at the same time, it's authentically containing the meaning that I want to put forth, so that it's almost like sugar-coated and not bashing a person in the head with whatever moral I think I found within the lesson. And I think I tried to carry that through the rest of them, and then through the process of just trying to be as authentic as I could with myself and learn what I could from the reports, it became just that. It became clear to me that they were reports I was reporting. So in some sense, what I'm saying is that voice just sort of was the byproduct of engaging in this like authentic mm-hmm. analysis of the psychedelic side. And I know you're familiar with that. It seems like those of us who are drawn back to these spaces are so because we share those common denominators. We're just trying to see what's going on. I think for the most part, we're not necessarily as interested with all of the rigmarole of the whole thing. We want to know. And then we come back and we have lessons to integrate. It's just that simple. You can't just take the joyride, right?
Yeah. So this recurring phrase, recurring theme is the call to adventure. So this comes up throughout the book and really in enjoyable ways. So tell us about what is the call to adventure and how do you interpret that for yourself? It seems like on a day-to-day, perhaps even moment-to-moment basis.
Yeah, I think it could be described in many different ways. There's like many different levels of analysis at which it would hit home. But in the sort of medium way to talk about it, which is like major life changes, I seem to hear it personally, and I don't think this is anything just that I am putting forth within even my circle of friends who have explored the psychedelics and basically just sought to understand to the best of their capacity what's going on here in the condition that we are bound within. They similarly and independently from me seem to use the same phrase, the same language. Like, I'm just not hearing the call to go camping and tripping with you right now. And I might say, oh, okay, great. You're not hearing it. But anyway, what is that? I don't know. I can't really tell you. I could tell you how it seems to look in my life. It's some intuition, I suppose, that I get that something needs to happen. The last one I got was that I needed to go out into solitude, into Western Texas in the desert and spend 4 days and nights alone. That was it. I heard this call, if you will, when I was in a forced meditation because I was attempting to get some rest during the day prior to an all-night flight that I had that evening, and I couldn't sleep, so I was in this forced meditation. I received this call, if you will. It said, go to the desert, be alone, figure out the next thing you need to do in your life. And it took a while. I refused the call for quite a while, but eventually I could not deny it. I started looking up the schedule of the park that I went to see what times would fit. It just all was something that clicked after I decided to take it. I went out there and I really merged with Source. That was the intent. And that is the word that I'm deliberately using. That's what it seemed like I did out there. And I came back from it with the knowing that I needed to essentially stop deluding myself. I had to go public with my work, with my writing, with my name, all of it. And I got back from that vision quest the next day with a call scheduled from my marketing company. I was working with a great marketing company out in actually Oregon as well, around Eugene. I launched my book, great guys. But anyway, I had this phone call the next day and I was simply reporting what I had gained out there. And someone on the phone call, it was a three-way phone call. She said, okay, great. Well, we'll run with your name and the books and all of that. What are you going to do with the whole process now? And I was hesitant. I was like, I don't know if I want to put my name on it. And anyway, she said, what did you just tell me? You just said that your call to adventure gave you this information and you have to integrate it to return home and be of the most value for yourself and fellow man. No. And I was, of course, that's what I have to do. But I was just in a position of not having fully integrated the vision quest myself. And then I had it reflected to me from her just by reporting the story, you see. And then, of course, that is taking form in the next book is a visionary quest. But anyway, that process, that call that I heard from the know not where that directed me to the next major breadcrumb seems to be something that does happen if you're open to it. And then, of course, you just sort of navigate strategically within. But I have found that to be a reoccurring pattern, especially when I seem to lose the trail or scent or whatever. Have you found things like this in your journey? I'm sure you have.
Yeah, well, I always like to pay attention to where the funniest of things show up and kind of present. One of the things I always share with people is that the call to recognize the genuine nature of reality, that invitation is present in every moment. And that the evidence for that is also present in every moment. You just need to pay attention to it. And that by engaging with that, then, you know, using the language that you present in the book is that you are uncovering immutable objective truth about the nature of reality and the nature of being, and that it's not about this belief system or that belief system, and that, again, as the way you present that, it could be found anywhere. That, you know, that in many, many people in the modern psychedelic world, you know, they're into, you know, oh, the sacred context and the sacred ceremony. But I think this is one of the things that's reflected in your book, that, you know, you really, you can find it anywhere. You know, it doesn't, we don't need, you know, some people want that. They want a lot of ritual. They want a lot of meaning. They want a lot of interpretation. But that it's accessible. And that really what it does require is you being willing to undergo the process of submitting yourself to it. And that sometimes it's really uncomfortable. And as you discuss within your books, that it is about kind of pushing those boundaries. And there's, even there, there's a fine balance that some people just like to push boundaries simply to push boundaries and are not receiving anything from it other than the thrill of pushing boundaries. But then there's also the pushing the boundaries so that then you can come back and integrate what you learned from that of moving out of your comfort zone, which might be a really powerful psychedelic trip, or it might be confronting an emotional or psychological reality about yourself that maybe you were unwilling to acknowledge or to integrate. But that willingness, and even through the discomfort of having a sense of trust, that there is a love that is unfolding here, even if it's very uncomfortable. Even if it hurts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of the above seems to be true. And I guess if I were to put a point on exactly what I was trying to say, where the call to development may come from, or the call to adventure, the way I normally frame it, I think it is capital S self. I really do. I think it is the Godhead. I think this calls us all forth in the world. And that's ultimately what it is. Now, I think our process of getting from our egoic character in this world to it and a clarified understanding of that, that is a process. That is something like the journey or whatever, right? And there are many, many shades of gray in between. And I know you're not super fond of this language, but I have termed that sort of like the higher self or soul in between. Perhaps that isn't to be used as an absolute objective reality in and of itself, but a useful sort of metaphor to show you that you could be in touch with the next thing to do. You don't need to know every turn around every next corner, but you could get that next breadcrumb if you're open to it and honest with where your intuition is guiding you. And then, of course, that's not to say that you're absolved of all responsibility and reason. You're not. But you strategically attempt to find out where that is, lead yourself into new info, integrate what it is that you have found, and undoubtedly you are coming to more of an understanding of yourself, your fellow man, and in that process, I would say the self.
Yeah, and I like the word that you use, and I was actually going to mention that earlier, the idea of sort of the clarification of the self, of who am I in relationship to others, who am I in relationship to the Godhead, who am I in relationship to the process of reality itself, and of course, my own life, my own choices, my own decisions, and where I am investing myself within my life. And that's a big theme within your books of wanting to, you know, time and again, you go back to, I don't want to be working for other people. I want to be working for myself. I want to support myself through my authentic transparency and revealing of myself and my process. And, you know, even that's a real tricky one that, you know, sometimes people have the idea like, well, if I'm just fully authentic and real, then the universe will support me in that. And the universe does support you in that, but it doesn't mean that it's actually going to be easy or that you're going to, you know, it's not that everything just falls in your lap at that point. You know, you're busy being your authentic self. And sometimes that creates ripples of reactions in others and misunderstandings. And so there's always the potential for blowback from that. And that things don't always work the way that you want them to work in the time, so that there is the disconnect between expectation and desire and then the results that are actually achieved. But then that, again, points us back to the idea of the process. Mm-hmm. That, well, it's a process. And that as living beings, we are always a work in progress. And our creativity is always a work in process, but finding meaning through self-expression, I don't know of anything that's personally more gratifying as an individual. you know, writing the next book, making the next piece of music, the next piece of art, and then sharing that, and then seeing how that is reflected and received by others. And then you take that as the next stepping stone for your own personal clarification and evolution.
Yeah, absolutely. Expression for sure. I mean, I even find it, I think, more so through this process, through conversation, where you're able to sit down as cosmic travelers, right, and compare notes and have a very open-ended question or, and answer session, a discussion, a dialogue through the logos you're able to speak. It's very interesting. On that note alone, I had a recent parking lot party here in Austin. I live in one of these big corporate apartment complexes, and from time to time, we just hang out in the parking lot as if you were camping, right?
Yeah. Kind
of bring a little Burning Man to the area. So I was hanging out with a really good friend of mine, and he's an extrovert, very naturally enthusiastic dude, and very deep guy. And someone came by, and he invited them into our circle, and we were hanging out, we were talking. And one way or the other, this person brought up what conversation was to each and every one of us. And my friend, with wisdom beyond his years, said that conversation was worship. That's what he said. He said worship. And what he meant, of course, was that through this process, if coming to it without a hard agenda, you give yourself and the other person hopefully the best chance to come to a little bit more of a clarified understanding of what's going on, or just the context of that conversation, whatever it might be. But in these more open-ended talks, you really do have the opportunity to appreciate the self within your fellow man. And if that process of understanding isn't worship, I don't know what would be. So that involves expression. It also involves listening. And then somewhere in there, when you're fully engaged in this, it is like those barriers between self and other in a non-dual way do start to dissolve. And you're realizing that you are the Godhead talking to itself. It seems like, and that's what he was saying in one word, worship. And I got it. And I just thought it was a beautiful way to describe expression within the context of even a conversation.
Yeah. And that really is, that's the meat of the magic, when you really can authentically meet another individual, authentically meet another person, and be seen by that person and see that person as well. And to have a level of communication that is just clear and it's upfront, that so much of our social interactions are governed by dissimulation and lies and falsehoods and projections and, you know, just the conveniences of normal everyday social living, and having that magic of like breaking down into, might even just be very simple language, but then recognizing that, and that there's an energy behind that where you can feel like, wow, we're having a real conversation here, that I'm actually getting to know this person. I'm not getting to know the person that he wants me to think he is, right? But it's the real person. And that can, of course, be facilitated through psychedelic conversations, but doesn't necessarily need to be through psychedelic conversations. That invitation to authenticity is always there. But it must be facilitated through actual conversation and dialogue, not the removed, you know, and what we see with social media and interactions, that things get off really quickly through people's projections and through how they want to be presented and present others, rather than having meaningful, engaging dialogue with each other. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that I like having a podcast, and I've done it for so long, is that I like getting to talk to people. I like getting to know people and to hear their stories and have them share and give them a space to do that and to be heard. And, you know, that is, it's fun. And I think it's also, it's a service to the people that I get to talk to, and it's a service to humanity, for all of us, to have more revealing, deepening conversations.
Right. I think podcasting in general is a natural evolutionary extension of the idea I was just talking about, that authentic conversation is worship, right? Because, I mean, it seems like some of the most well-regarded podcasts are unedited. They're not cut, and they're long form. And people like that. They really do. It resonates deeply with a form of what we're describing, an authenticity, for lack of a better term. It is the best term. It's the most clear term. I think it's what we're all aimed at. And that's great that we have now a space where we can do that. And not only for you and I, but of course, there are going to be listeners, and then they're able to touch on this presence too. And that's awesome. One other thing I did want to mention, though, as you were talking about authenticity earlier, which I think is key, I think the Stones summed it up really well too. you can't always get what you want, but, well, you get what you need, right? So the radical authenticity that I think we're both talking around the edges of or just trying to describe isn't to be thought of as going around in the world and just announcing yourself fully and completely as your egoic character at all times. It's not a license to be a jerk. That's not what we're talking about. It's something other than that. It's trying to get to a fundamental reality that you are inhabiting in that moment of space and time, and then just being real with that and hopefully communicating in a way that is, that's useful. That's not a contributor to chaos, but helps the understanding of the individual at the very least, something along those lines. So I think if you are to do that, you give yourself the best possible chance in a strategic way to find what might be highest and best use, the way I'm always encapsulating the metaphysical treasure, right? It's not a guarantee, and I would never say such a thing. Life's rough. There are a bunch of anomalies within the matrix. There's a lot of suffering here. But if we're talking about strategies that seem to work and have been sort of time-tested through tradition and wisdom and what are contained within some of the mythologies, when you begin to abstract that process out, for me, it does seem like something that transparency and radical authenticity is a way that gives yourself the best aim at highest and best use. Having found that, now you will potentially be able to ride that into being the best way to be in the world for yourself and fellow man through sustainable fulfillment. So something like that in formula. And I just wanted to say that oftentimes the process of engaging in that kind of authenticity is not going to bring the ego the result that it thought it wanted.
No.
Right? Because this is evolution in a very different way. But like you were talking about before, and I just wanted to remark upon that, it gives you something that you need to learn, some context, some structure, and then from there you have the opportunity, and perhaps you've even gained a tool to move forward with in your journey.
Yeah. So let's bring it back to the personal love level, because this is a recurrent theme that shows up throughout the books of romantic relationships, tripping mushrooms with different women, questions of will this go sexual, will this go romantic, will it not, archetypal representations of the goddess energy, both within the physical form of the female as well as through music or through just the mushrooms themselves. You know, this is something, you know, just about mushrooms and psychedelic sex, something that I think not enough people really talk about, that there can be these really profound sexual experiences that happen on psychedelics that are not involving another person. That it often can be very erotic for people, and that sometimes people are, I don't know, they get a little bit weird about that they don't want to talk about it. Like I was having a consultation yesterday with a fellow telling me about, he had his very first experience with 5-MeO-DMT. And he said, well, at the peak, it was just an orgasm. It was just an orgasm that just kept going and going and going. It's like, well, yeah, that's it. You know, that's what it is. But, you know, feel free to, you can recount maybe some of the stories that are here in the books about sort of this ongoing romantic sexual cultivation of yourself as in the model of the way of the superior man, the attempts, the failures, the striving. Whatever you'd like to share there, because it's a reoccurring theme.
Yeah, for sure. I think there are all of these taboos we have within, of course, our culture. And it has seemed odd to me, but somewhat common, that they all sort of revolve or center with things that we'd rather not talk about. Well, they are things we'd rather not talk about, but they center on very hard-hitting, undeniable realities. So, for example, death. Well, we all know that, but best not go there, right? And similarly, which is the other end of that spectrum, sex and the creational act itself. It's like, no, that's probably not the best topic for dinner with your mom and dad or whatever, right? Culturally, that is. But the psychedelic experience is another one. And I've just seen that being in the same category. It's like this cultural taboo we have. No, not to talk about that. And it's somewhat remarkable how they all have everything to do with each other.
Yeah.
Right? So the transcendent psychedelic experience could have everything to do with an egoic death. It could have everything to do with feeling the creational ecstasy of sexual pleasure itself. It's not surprising that they're all tied up into this one transcendent experience of time and space in the way that we normally think about it. So yeah, specifically for me, the first time I launched off into that space was with a heavy mushroom dose, of course, by myself alone. and I simply just eliminated sensory input. I laid down, and it seemed to me as though I was engaged in a sort of interdimensional, transcendent sexual act with, I don't know, the mushroom goddess, if you will, right? This sort of non-entity. It wasn't as if I was with a being in any incorporated form. It was just a energy, a presence, a vibe, mm-hmm. if you will. And it was extraordinarily sexual and erotic and extremely pleasurable, for sure. And I had felt in that experience like, this is actual sex. Like we've only been touching upon the shadows and on the cave wall with all other physical experiences being sober and within our regular thought structures and such. Like, this is the real suchness. And of course, you can touch upon that too with another person if you are in such spaces, such mushroom spaces and all of that. But I guess what I have to really say about that is the undeniable act of creation itself also seems to be inherently in the psychedelic space, right? It's like that is creation of form or the prime suchness that comes to be in, comes down in form in our three-dimensional reality or something like that. And those are the rivers in the background or something of creational suchness itself. And it perhaps does feel like the act of sexual gratification within three-dimensional reality. That might be the way we touch upon that entire iceberg. And perhaps when we do it without being altered, we are just touching on a very tiny part of that iceberg. And then with the psychedelic experience introduced by ourselves or with someone else, you just perhaps even by yourself is better at first, because you begin to really strip away all the layers that allows you to see more of that entire iceberg or something. And it feels very creational, I would say, on that.
Yeah. And I would say it's also combined, that it's not, it's like there's sex and eroticism and the pleasure and the ecstasy with that. But then there's also the pleasure and the ecstasy of death and destruction and even consuming that. And the birthing, kind of all of these are shades of the same fundamental process of the universal self creating, consuming, making love with, destroying, recreating, rebirthing itself again and again and again and again and again. It's like this never-ending process of the recycling of the self through these different stages of interaction, consummation, destruction, and recreation, that all of these energies are related to each other, and that they can, you know, in a deep psychedelic experience, they can kind of all show up together or even show up in different stages. But I think that they're all related to each other, and that this is part of, you know, to use your language of sort of the meat suit space primate, that we're kind of fumbling through all of this, that we're, you know, we want to have our romantic relationship and our sex lives. And of course we have to, you know, concern ourselves with eating food, and we live in fear of death. And then we're all trying to birth new possibilities for ourselves all the time. So we're always doing this, that it's playing out through all these different forms and through these particularities of our lives. But the archetypal energy of all this is kind of what underlies all of it. And that's what, on occasion, we get access to through these psychedelic states. And then sometimes we get to share it with others in that state. And then it, you know, takes on a whole new level. Like, as you were describing somewhere in the later books, maybe it was even the last one, about being with a particular woman while on mushrooms and having the distinct impression, like, my God, the mushroom goddess is like actually speaking through this woman right now. And that's another experience that I can really highly relate to, that, you know, if you haven't gotten to it yet, it's in my book, Being Infinite, where I was smoking Salvia Divinorum with my wife, Jesslyn, and it just clicked, like, oh shit, Salvia is talking through her. I'm talking to Salvia through her. And it was a really uncanny experience while that was taking place. And it sounds like you've had somewhat of a similar experience, and maybe you'd like to relate some of that.
Yeah, that's odd, isn't it? When that happens, when you feel like you are talking to the spirit of the organic medicine. Yeah, that's quite a head scratcher. But in the moment, it seems like that is what is happening. Yeah, in that specific experience, that's exactly what was happening. I was camping with a woman who had actually read my first book, and that introduced her to the psychedelics. She had never been a participant in that realm before, and then she went to her first burn and she was offered some acid, and she took it in a responsible way, and it was very growth catalyzing for her. She felt the benefits of it. And then, so after that, she got back in touch with me. We were just casual friends, and we began dating a little bit, and we went camping together. And so we took a moderate dose of the mushroom together, and we eventually ended up having sex, because that's kind of just what happens, as you know, in those spaces. And through the process, I essentially found that she seemed to be, like I described, a manifestation of the mushroom goddess. And I was communing with the spirit of the mushroom goddess through her, as if she were a medium of some sort. But it was also very odd, too, because I was closing my eyes at various points, and I had the active memory of the face of the mushroom goddess from a previous trip, long, long ago, years before. And it seemed like that's who was before me. And this mushroom goddess of my vision even had otherworldly purple makeup. It was purple for some reason. And it was sort of that mushroom language that I'm sure you've seen before. It's like that language of creation with all the symbols and signs. Alison Gray comes to mind. She paints a lot of that sort of creative language. But anyway, I opened my eyes and there it was, you know, superimposed atop of her and her face and everything, and closed my eyes and there it was. And so my outer and inner worlds were totally matching up. They were consistent, and my mind did not know what to make of this. Of course, this is not supposed to be possible. This is only going on in my head versus reality, right? Well, no. What was happening inside and outside. It was a reality that was in front of me. And it was funny that the note I made of that was that I had to be in the present moment. If I attempted in any way to cycle a reflective thought about that, it started to turn chaotic and I felt it. So I had to be there. I suppose in a pleasurable way, this would be an example of doing something that's incredibly engaging, like being on a hike on very uneven terrain or something like that. Or the static line might be a better example. You see people walk on the static line. It's like balancing. You're so focused on what you're doing that there's no room for any thought other than what's immediately in front of you. So you're sort of forced to be in the present moment. And after that trip, I reflected on that and I thought, how odd is it that that is so alien to at least modern day in, day out life for me, that it took that immense experience to sort of force me into the pleasure of the present moment and just embrace it as it was. And it got so odd for both of us that we actually stopped. We actually stopped the act. Yeah. And we talked about it. We started talking about what was happening. And I convinced myself and she convinced herself that essentially she was a medium for the mushroom goddess. She seemed to be telling me things about my life path and all of this, and in a way that we had never talked about before, right? And it was as if these wisdoms truly were coming from this higher order space that she had access to, and she was imparting this to me essentially like your life path has not been for nothing, that sort of thing. Because you know how it is, it's constantly fraught with a doubt and insecurity, or it can be in some of these weird spaces. And she was reaffirming that perhaps it seems that way to the ego mind, but that is not the case. There is a purpose to all of it. So that was that basic experience, and I think for both of us it was something that left us scratching our heads for a very long time afterward.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that really you just have to be available for it. You know, like as you're saying, that as the discursive mind comes in and starts to question and like, whoa, what's really going on here? I got to think about this. That then you lose it. You know, it's kind of like sometimes with visions, with psychedelics, you can only see them by not looking at them. And then there's other times that you can only see them by not moving your eyesight. And then you're able to see it. And so this is kind of one of those things where it's like, if you let yourself go with it, if you're available for it, that people can become these channels for these deep levels of energy to express themselves, surprisingly, in ordinary everyday language that can be deeply resonant within that moment. And that it does distinctly feel like, wow, I'm talking directly to the energy. I'm not talking to the person, that the person has made themselves available to be the medium or the channel. And that can be taken to extremes of, you know, spiritual and religious belief of, oh, I'm a channel and this is the entity I worked with, whatever. But just within that moment, I just like how it arose spontaneously. And it's not that then the woman went out and started proclaiming herself like, okay, I am the mushroom goddess, so come and talk to me, right? It's something that arises in the moment and it doesn't need to shape an identity, but the availability for that in the present moment does take sort of that heroic adventure mentality of, we're really in uncharted territory right now, and this is really blowing my mind, but okay, let's roll with it. Let's see what we can access through that. And even if you have to stop your lovemaking to center on that, you know? So this is just part of the weirdness that shows up with psychedelics.
Right. And what's also interesting to note about that is when we did stop and began talking, it's not as if the pleasure of the situation stopped. I think it was highly fulfilling for both of us to engage in that sort of conversation. It was an extension of the, say, sexual bliss and pleasure we were deriving from the act of making love into a conversational version of that, being in the same space, though, on the same vibe. And she a couple of times corrected me, and rightfully so, because I did begin to start to reflect on it, like, oh, this is weird. I was already writing the trip report. Yeah, and she just kind of brought me back to center, like, no, maybe not so much. Let's come back. And that was great. It was like, yeah, let's enjoy what we have here. And you're right, too. That did happen spontaneously. And I would say you're also very correct. She had to be open to that sort of thing as I had to be open to. And we both were. So it worked out. It was a recipe for it potentially working out the best it could, and it did in that circumstance. In many ways, I felt like that trip of us camping together, it was just for a single night. It was probably grand total, I don't know, not even 24 hours from meeting and going and coming back and all of this. It felt like that's what dating should be like. Like, it should be something like that, right? Like, I had known her for months, and we had gone out a couple times previous. We'd even been intimate, but it felt like we had a meeting of each other there and then in a very real way. And I just couldn't help but think that afterward, like, that was a first date. It was one of the most pure sort of first dates I'd ever been on. But of course, try advertising that on Bumble or Tinder, and you're not going to get too many responses.
Yeah. So within your books, you know, as we've been discussing here, that you have a lot of different trip contexts. That it's not the same thing every time. You know, sometimes you're alone, eyes closed, you're in sensory deprivation. Other times you're alone, you're listening to Spotify playlists. Other times you're out camping. Other times you're out, like, wandering around, going to the pools, going camping, going to regional burn events. Yet you're able to distill meaning and lessons and value from all of these. So do you have any kind of personal hierarchy or, you know, in terms of the context of your experiences, are they all equal for you? Do you find certain contexts are better at certain stages of your journey? Just what are your reflections on that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's almost tough to answer because in some sense, I would say that you do get what you need at the time that you need it. Right. Or something like that. So that does look different. Right. And I'm sure you're familiar with that. If you're called to perhaps go to a burn or invited to do so, and perhaps previously you had only done solo work with a psychedelic, well, this is now an invitation to perhaps step outside of that a little bit. Not to say that you can never go back to solo work, but you can still do it. But if you're in Rome, well, do as the psychedelic Romans do. Right. Get out there and enjoy. So it just depends on where you are in your journey with it. But to concisely come back and not avoid your question and present you with an answer, I would simply say that the most value I have found from these things, it really is the solo work. So it is high doses of the mushroom and alone, essentially with eliminating sensory input to experience the mushroom, right? As purely as is possible. Let it give me what is needed as opposed to obscuring that process in any way. However, that being said, you can use them with a different intent for different purposes and still gain realizations that might even be key for you. It might also be that I am saying, perhaps if you feel called to do the solo work, that is the most appropriate thing that you need to be doing with that organic medicine at that point in your journey. However, if you do find yourself in a certain space that is conducive to tripping with others and you're invited to do so, maybe it is that your journey is presenting you with that as the most potential useful tool for your development. So it just kind of depends on where you are at with these things. And if you don't feel a call, then perhaps no work with the medicines is the most appropriate thing to be doing with yourself at that point in time. I just think it all depends. But there are certainly a lot of uses for such things. And it's just up to us to navigate with the tool that is most appropriate for us at that stage in the journey. And as you know, you only figure out how to do that by exploration.
Yeah. one of the things that I like that showed up a couple times in the book was tripping with your dad. And that's something that, you know, I don't know how many people actually get to have that experience. My parents themselves, they are curious about my own world, but you know, they haven't wanted to step into it in any way. Though I will say, I don't even know if my mom will want me to say this, but anyway, I'll say it anyway, that a few years ago, you know, after recreational cannabis was legalized here in Oregon, she came up for a visit and she's like, well, can I give it a try? You know? And so I gave her my vape pen and she's like, I don't think it's doing anything. But that was, you know, that was very adventurous for my mom, you know, someone who just is not interested in altered states of consciousness, is made very uncomfortable by too much self-reflection, a lot of anxiety. You know, I love you, Mom. I'm not trying to diss you, Mom, here on the podcast. I'm, you know, just trying to be honest. But you got to trip with your dad and have a couple different experiences with him. And it seemed like that was quite meaningful for you. So maybe tell us a little bit about that and getting to trip with dad, which again, not a lot of people get to trip with their parents.
You're right. That is an opportunity that not many have had, and I'm fortunate enough to have had it. I gained a real serious lesson from that the second time around I tripped with my dad. So I only did it twice, and the first time was pretty nice. I mean, it was a light ride. We didn't have a lot. We had a light appreciative dose, what I often call the Zen appreciation dose, which is just about a gram of the dried mushroom. Just a good introductory amount, I feel like, for people. And my dad had never messed with the psychedelics before. But of course, I had told him about my whole journey. He was familiar, and I explained what it was, the time frame and all of that. So he was informed, and he said, yeah, let's do it. It was Memorial Day weekend. One year in Chicago, I was at his house with him, and we were just outside, beautiful day there, and we were just appreciating the yard. And at one point, he asked me if it was working, and I said, well, yeah, it is for me. I mean, it just might take you a little bit to see. And with the questions that he asked me then thereafter, I realized it was working. He was just seeing the trees and telling me he thought they were breathing and that they looked like big broccoli. or that he was seeing a sea anemone in the tree. I'm like, yeah, Dad, see, realizations like that or observations like that are an indication that it is working. So we were just in that kind of fun space, and we both, I think, got value from that. That was cool. Eventually, our neighbor came out, who's really close to our family and very tight with us, which was cool, but how do we negotiate this, right? We were there high.
Yeah.
So our neighbor's out not knowing anything, and we couldn't exactly say that. So we just kind of wrote it out. My dad's very much an extrovert, so he was able to incorporate my neighbor into conversation, and everything was fine. It was cool. So that was the first time. The second time I tripped with my dad, it was different. I basically told him that if you're using these things to understand more of yourself, well, you should up the dose, right? And I said I would recommend, in this case, about doubling that, so about two and a half. And he was down, and I was down. And the conditions were way worse. It was November in Chicago, and we went out in our yard, and we built a fire, but that didn't do much. It was cold and windy. It just cut through us. It was extreme, to say the least. So we were out there physically suffering, and, of course, that kind of shaded the experience a little bit for my dad, too. And he wasn't feeling it. He wasn't having necessarily a bad time, but I could tell that he wasn't willing to let go as much as a person would need to start to get the benefits from it. So we moved inside eventually after like 3 hours. We really put in our time out there. And then we had a very good chat as we started to come down. I mean, this involved essentially my dad getting caught up in the experience. And I just told him, I flat out announced, I grabbed his leg, slapped his knee, grabbed it kind of firmly. And I told him, Dad, I love you. Like, it's cool. We trust each other here. There's no problems. Yeah, we're in a little bit different territory than normally, but it's cool. And he wasn't freaking out or anything like that. I don't want to make it sound like that, but that was cool. You know, that was just sort of a moment of legit bond between us that I probably wouldn't have had if we did not trip together. It's just not exactly a random thing between us. And then, of course, we talked each other down sort of very nicely and comfortably throughout the rest of the experience, and that was fine. Sometime after that, my dad basically said that he didn't think he was going to get any kind of use out of furthering his understanding of the psychedelics through direct experience. And I said, yeah, of course, Dad. But it was that trip that really told me to chill, to chill on advocating psychedelics for everyone. And I don't do that anymore. That even though I write about them, that has been my call to adventure. Like I have been telling you, my basic theme there is we do have it. It is specific to each and every one of us, which hopefully leads us to highest best use, sustainable fulfillment, and all that. This is a way that some of us have found to that mountaintop, right? It's a pathway. But it is not, certainly not the only pathway, and is not for everyone, plain and simple. So I really came to understand that after that last experience with my dad, and that was extremely useful for me to just know that this has been my path. The idea of a path, I think, has validity to it, but the psychedelics just might not be in everyone's journey, plain and simple.
Yeah, and it's certainly natural for, I think, a lot of people who get involved with psychedelics to, I call it sort of the evangelical stage, where you want to talk about it as much as possible, because, you know, for those of us who receive benefit from it, who are astounded by it, it's like, my God, why wouldn't, you know, you use the metaphor of, well, let's imagine you're on a spaceship and there is a phone you could pick up and you could actually talk to the ship and like find out like what's going on versus talking to other people. And, you know, I'm right there with you. It's like, yeah, I'd want to pick up that phone. And there can be the assumption that, well, certainly everybody would want to pick up that phone, but that's not actually true. That not everybody really does want to pick up the phone. That because that quote unquote call to adventure, it's uncanny, it's uncomfortable, it's hard to understand at times, and so yeah, not everybody is ready for a psychedelic experience. I think at heart, you know, I think everybody could benefit from a psychedelic experience while also recognizing that it's not right for anyone. Like, we couldn't, like, universally say everybody's ready for a psychedelic experience right now in this moment. And I think at some point in their lives, I think any person could benefit from it, potentially. But it always has to be their choice. And so the evangelical stage where we want to convince everybody, yeah, everybody take psychedelics, that sometimes that can be overstepping. And that it's not necessarily right for everyone right where they are right at that moment, and being able to recognize that and then maybe back off a little bit and say, well, I've gotten a lot out of it and I want to share about that. And then maybe other people, they can make their choice based on whether they feel that call or not feel that call.
Right, right. That all seems to be the tried and true wisdom of why it makes sense to come into these things on your own terms. Yeah. And I think in many ways, what I just gave you was an outline of an example where my dad wasn't doing that. My dad was doing it for me. He's always been my ride or die. I mean, he loves me to death. He'd do anything for me. And that's just awesome. So he came into that realm because, well, I'm his son. I'm telling him, hey, Dad, this is useful. And so he came for me. But it wasn't that he came into it the same reasons that I did, which was to heal a heartbreak and understand and all of this. So exactly as you said, I think it could certainly be beneficial for a great deal of people if they come to it on their own terms and for, dare I say, the right reasons, just meaning that they're attempting to understand the experience on their own terms, learn what they can about it in that territory, explore as productively as they can, and then bring something home. That all has to sort of be the substructure there, more or less. And if it's not, I just don't see that they're going to be helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really got to be that person's choice. And they've got to be doing it for themselves, ultimately, which can seem perhaps ironically selfish, but that's the way that it works. That you never take psychedelics for other people. Don't take psychedelics to please other people. And if you're trying to talk somebody into taking psychedelics to please you, well then, you know, you might want to back off of that, because it's about presenting the information and then saying, so if you're interested, here's the best information I can give you about it. But it's gotta be your choice whether you're gonna do this or not.
Right. And free will is prime. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And speaking of free will and speaking of choice, as we've already mentioned that, you know, our three primary characters, we've got cannabis, which you talk about how, why didn't I not discover cannabis until I was 30? And then you seem to enjoy it quite a bit. We've got a couple ayahuasca journeys that are mentioned. Everything else is mushrooms. So I'm just kind of curious, you know, the books, they're all relatively recent. They've all been published within the last 2 years, including even this year, I think. That, you know, for me, my first maybe decade worth of psychedelic experience was all just cannabis and mushrooms. And then I discovered Salvia divinorum. And at this point, I've tried a lot of different things. So I'm just curious about yourself that you seem very comfortable in high dose mushroom space. Are you looking to broaden your psychedelic horizons with other medicines, or are you just sticking with mushrooms? What are your thoughts and feelings on that?
Well, that kind of goes back to what I was talking about before. It just depends on where the journey takes me, right? That's a big part of just being open to understand new information and move forth the best you can. If, say, acid was to come into my journey, I would consider it. Would I seek it out? No, I wouldn't. And in some way, I suppose I am rather comfortable with the mushroom specifically because it was my first breakthrough experience. There was a lot that I gained from it. In the beginning, I always felt very cared for by it, very, very loved by it. Not to say I didn't have some challenging trips. Of course you do in these spaces, but ultimately I never felt threatened or anything of that nature. And one of the main reasons that I like to talk about what it was that really brought me to the psychedelics is because that's actually what happened. It really was that I was trying to heal a heartbreak. That's just the truth. But my intention was always that. It was always to heal. And so I did grow my own mushrooms, and I've never eaten anything from anyone else when it comes to the mushroom. So I guess part of what I'm saying is not dissimilar from the way an ayahuascaro or perhaps a shaman would impart his intention to the brew, right? And that is supposedly to have an effect upon that brew. I think unconsciously, or subconsciously, I should say, I was always doing that with the mushroom. I always sought to heal, even outside of the acute attention that I had for an experience at hand. That was always what I brought to the table of growing, of cultivating, of bringing it to me, and then, of course, consuming and on the trips, then getting whatever I could to ultimately be of the most benefit for my growth. So that process then led me to ayahuasca. So you see, it was like all stemming from my own growth-centric hand, if you will, the higher self's hand that was guiding or something like that. And that's been the reason that I've stuck with the mushroom. And then just as a sort of side note, I would say to that, I think there might be the idea that mushrooms are just sort of silly. They're not that serious or something like that out in the psychedelic world of those who don't know a ton about it. I don't think that's true. It's just simply a dosage amount. So if you were to take a gram or a couple grams and simply go to a concert, that's cool. I have no problem with that. I don't think you would either. There's no problem. That's a use for the thing. And you can certainly gain some epiphanies from said experience. But if you're looking to dose with, say, 8 grams, because it represents the infinite in the desert by yourself for 4 days and nights, that's what I did last time around. That's a very different experience, of course. And it's every bit as weird as the heaviest ayahuasca experience I've ever had. So my point with sticking with the mushrooms is that I simply am comfortable and familiar with it. It has been my teacher, my guru, if you will, right? That's reflected the self to me, the mushroom. And I've grown a relationship with it, not dissimilar from the way a person would grow a relationship with, say, cannabis or something along those lines, or any tool, any aid that they have. It's just been basically the mushroom for me. And the last time that I went there and had my very transcendent experience out with a very heavy amount of them, I realized that I don't feel a need to search for any other answers. It's almost like if we're looking for error codes in the matrix or something like that to inform ourselves about the self, you can use a bunch of different lenses, but if you have lenses that work, why switch them? And that's more or less my mentality when it comes to the mushroom specifically. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that just to pick up on something you kind of mentioned here is that in the broader psychedelic community, I do think that ayahuasca has been somewhat fetishized with the idea of, oh, well, it has all this tradition and there's these songs and the Ikaros and the shamans, and they've got all this lineage of knowledge. And that I think that especially at higher dose mushrooms, that it's really hard to distinguish between mushrooms and ayahuasca. You know, that we're both working with a variation of DMT here, and that the spaces that they open up, the levels of realizations and experiences, they're very, very similar. So I don't see a huge fundamental difference between ayahuasca and mushrooms, and that, you know, just what's missing in the mushroom side of things is the ceremony, you know, and kind of the allure of the exotic other, of like, oh, well, you know, the shamanism and, you know, all of that, versus, you know, I can just take mushrooms and do it on my own. I don't need to travel to South America for something like that. So I do think that mushrooms have kind of gotten dismissed a little bit within the broader culture because it doesn't have the same fetishization around the exotic other with that. Even though, of course, in consuming the mushroom, it is exotically other. It is exotically strange. It is also exotically beautiful. And, I love how you mentioned, just the platonic forms, the perception of energy in structures that is communicating things that, because, sometimes I talk to people about their mushroom experiences, like, I saw a few bits of geometry on the walls and things were breathing a little bit. And I said, well, how about, have you had your eyes open and have the entire space between you and the wall filled with intricate geometry that's communicating to you? And I was like, no. It's like, okay, well then you don't really know what mushrooms are about yet. You know, which is fine. If you're not comfortable with that, that's fine. But that's where mushrooms do take you, to this complete dissolution into this complete and total infinite energetic state that is alive and interactive and conscious. That's different than just munching on a little mushroom chocolate and going for a hike or going to a concert, which, as you say, is great. There's nothing wrong with that. Not everybody needs to go heroic. But when you do, that's when things get really, really interesting.
For sure. And just to that point, I think it's worth mentioning, too, that the mushroom is all self-contained. Right. So some way it is the perfect psychedelic for weirdos like us who just want to kind of get into it, dive in and understand to the best of our abilities, hard as we can, outside of all of that other structure, which, again, I'm not throwing under the bus. But yeah, there's definitely a difference in, let's say, your personal authenticity and intention you're bringing to a heavy mushroom experience that you could attain on your own from the safety of your own house compared to venturing out to a foreign country and then going through the whole protocol. It's just different. There's something available that's very different. But I mean to say that the mushroom in many ways might sort of be like nature's perfect. Here you go. If you want to take the call, I am ready to answer.
Yeah, because it's just right there, Yeah. Like, are you familiar with Kalindi Iyi at all?
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, Kalindi passed away last year, but he was an advocate of 40 grams and up of mushrooms, and he's a really avid mushroom explorer. He's a really, really dynamic individual, and that was his take on mushrooms as well, was like, look, people get wrapped up in all this ayahuasca stuff, or then you got the Native American church and you got all the ceremonies, like, but you don't have to prepare mushrooms. There's nothing you need to do. You just pick the damn thing and eat it. And then keep eating them was his take on it. It's like, keep going and just eat a whole bunch of them and then shut the fuck up, sit down, pay attention. And, so he had just kind of he was into martial arts as well. And so that was kind of his approach to mushrooms. But yeah, he said that it's the perfect psychedelic because you don't have to dry it. You don't have to smoke it. You don't have to make a particular brew out of it. You don't have to combine it with something else. You don't have to, remove part of it. It's just perfectly self-contained and it's immediately accessible and they grow all over the world. So they don't, in a sense, it's not like, like some people, when they talk about peyote, they say, well, that's Native American medicine, or ayahuasca, that's a South American medicine. But psilocybin mushrooms grow all over the world. So they don't really belong to anyone. It's not any particular culture or society's medicine. That it's something that all human beings have had access to, in a sense, throughout human history. And it continues to be the case because there's psilocybin mushrooms all around the world. So it's kind of a universal psychedelic in that sense.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's reliable.
Right. That's a very good point too. And I just want to remark on something you said there. Yeah. 40 fresh grams and up, which is about 10% in the dried state. So like when I talk about 4 grams or 5 grams, that would be like equivalent to 40 or 50 fresh or whatever. So yeah, that seems to be that space that you want to be shooting for. If you're looking to do the heavy solo work, I would say around that heroic dose, 5 grams dried or 50 fresh or right in there. because universally it's going to behave more or less the way that it does and always has within our species. And the test of time has proven that it is perhaps the origin of religion itself, right? Some of those earliest like cave paintings are of the mushroom man where he's got mushrooms growing out of him and stuff. Yeah, so it really could be traced back. And then, of course, if you've had some of these experiences, it's no stretch at all of the imagination to say I could certainly see how structure was built around this as the fundamental thing that brought us into a mystical state of comprehension of the grand all or something like that. And then, of course, the thing was eventually removed, it seems like, from various religions, and now you just had the structure without the actual thing, right? So you know about that, but obviously, But yeah, I could certainly say that mushrooms seem to be the ticket. They have been for me, at least. And just to highlight one more time, because they're so accessible. I mean, it might not be that a person is able to go to a different country or just plug into a native tribe for peyote or for ayahuasca, but most people are going to be able to get their hands on some mushrooms if they want.
Yeah. So I've had you on for a while. I just have a couple more things and then we can wrap it up. One is, now with the completion of these four books, what's next, or is this the next of getting interviews, spreading the word about the books, giving talks? What's on your plate?
Yeah, well, I'm halfway through writing the fifth in the Visionary Quest series. They're probably going to be something I do until I reach number 8, right? The infinite. Right. I feel like that might be the thing to do there. So at least I'll continue to go that far. And mainly because I do use them as pivot points in life. So that last one I was describing, when I was in the desert, it essentially told me to do this full time, which I am now doing. I've quit my day job to do just this. So exactly as you said, I'm really trying to plug into the community now to have these conversations, to just impart what it is that I have found to be the case. I'm 33, and I just feel like at this point in my life, this is most likely the next thing to be doing, which is as consistent as it would be with me finding highest and best use. If it's not this, I have absolutely no idea what it would be. So I just have to plug into the community in this way. And that's what I'm attempting to do now through, of course, essentially talking about these books and then continuing the process at hand so that I'm actually living it out, right? That's a part of it too. You're not just talking about all of these things and I'm not actually living it. No, I have to look at myself in the mirror at the end of every day. So I'm trying to live it out. And that's just where I am right now. It's a task. I'm certainly in the unknown, but I have the tools that are required to forge ahead productively, and I'm engaged right now fully in that process.
Right on. So how can people find you and find your materials?
Yeah, everything is available at travelingatnobody.net. It has all links to all my books. It'll take you to Amazon. A new podcast I just started to do the same very thing, and will be linked up there, Traveling at Nobody's, which is basically just worship in the way that we are doing here by comparing notes with other cosmic travelers. And that's it, travelingnobody.net.
All right. So last question. Since we started with heartbreak, how's your heart today?
It's good. It's good. It's all devoted to what I've just talked about, to now forging ahead in this space. That's where it completely is. I am single, and I just have been given, actually by the mushroom before, the notion that there's a very real order of operations that has to seemingly happen for my character in this world. It is that I find that treasure, highest and best use, or something close enough to it, which is just meaning that I could find a way to actually generate income, which is sustainable and consistent with who and what I am. I don't have to hide myself. I don't have to not discuss these things or sweep them under the carpet. In fact, the point is to openly talk about them. So in pursuit of that, and hopefully having found it, only then would I potentially be given the chance to have romantic female love in my life, to be graced by that presence or something. The mushroom essentially communicated that to me. In essence, it was saying, do this, be productive, and now you'll be in the right place to potentially have legitimate female love in your life. And I said, it's kind of tough to argue with that. So that's where my real love is. It's very geared at finding out the best way to essentially be in the world through the experiences that I've had. And right now that just looks like putting the bits of truth and wisdom, I guess, if you will, that I have found out to the world, and then actively being someone who's available for conversations like this and just a participant in the space to figure things out together. And that's where love is pointed right now.
All right. Right on, John. Well, it's been great talking to you today. I'm really glad that you originally reached out to me. Thank you also for gifting me with the physical copies of the books. You know, I gave you the option, like, hey, send me a PDF, but if you want to send me the books, I dig that. And you sent me the books. And thanks for following up that you know, sometimes it takes a little pressing the button of, so when are we going to do it? Lit the fire under my butt to get these books read. But it's been a pleasure to speak with you today. It was a pleasure to read your books. I definitely recommend them. So I'm just going to plug them one more time. It's the Visionary Quest series. It starts with the organic spaceship opening the psychedelic door by the traveling nobody. Check it out. It's a quick read. It's fun, and it'll probably leave you wanting more. It did for me. We'll see if it does for other people. But it's been great to talk to you today, John.
Thank you very much, Martin. I appreciate it.
All right.